You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my co-host and wonderful mother is sitting here with me.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's nice soft rain. We need a little moisture, so we're doing good.
Just not too much.
No.
We've had more than our share in some ways this year. But here in Fairfield, we've actually been very blessed with our rain this year. We've had enough at all the right times for my garden anyway.
Yeah. Well, they're still trying to open up 34 into Illinois. And I live in Mount Pleasant, so I get the Hawkeye. And so they're hoping to get it this weekend to get that open, and I hope so too.
Yeah, it's been closed for a really long time.
Mm-hmm, it has.
Wow. Well, we have a very interesting guest back with us today.
Yes.
We tried to interview this person about a month ago and got interrupted by some power outage that shut down the whole station for the first time in almost 2 years that we've been on the air. Just our luck to be the ones to have that happen. But I know that James, the station manager, and the technical crew had a lot more problems than we did with that in that regard, getting things back up and running.
Oh, so, yeah, because you got all the computers and everything.
Yeah, so my hat's off to them. So with us today, once again, is Mike Polacek. Mike's a writer living in Northwest Iowa who's written several novels. In fact, the one that we have to talk about today is his 10th. He's a former federal prisoner for peace, a small-town newspaper reporter, an Iowa congressional candidate. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. Give it a second try.
Hopefully we'll make it the whole time.
How long were you off without power last time?
I'm not sure, but it was till the end of our normal course, which would be 2 o'clock and then beyond. So I don't know.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They were able to run on backup. Some of the equipment here is on backup power for a little while, but then they lost that. And I never really understood if they figured out what caused.
Well, there was some power people doing things around town, and
yeah.
There's a lot of stuff going around Fairfield now. We're building all sorts of things, so that could have been it.
So anyway, Mike, we're probably going to cover some of the same ground that we started to cover last time, but it was very interesting, and so if anyone heard it before, I'm sure they'll be willing to hear it again. Tell us a little bit about about your background and how you started writing novels.
Well, I'm from Nebraska, originally Norfolk, Nebraska. I guess I'll just try and go through this quick. I was in seminary in 79, and then Catholic seminary, and then I went to, Dan Berrigan, Father Dan Berrigan, and I started thinking more about peace and justice issues, and I ended up leaving the seminary, but I started getting more involved in protest work, and I moved to Omaha and started getting arrested at the Strategic Air Command off at Air Force Base. And through the 80s, I went to, I spent a little bit of time in county jail and federal prisons. I had a pretty hard time, actually. I kind of flipped out, I guess you'd call it. I don't know. It was just really hard. Just very, not flipped out, but very deep depression. So I had to, my last jail term was 6 months in the Council Bluffs County Jail for an off action. And I just felt that I couldn't do it again. I just get too depressed and too chronic, just deep depression. So after I went into, I thought about what to do, and Ruth and I had a son by then. Sam was 2 years old. So, started working construction, and construction made me think about a possible newspaper career, I guess. So I went into newspaper work for most of the 90s, I guess. And then I just wanted to try writing novels. So I've been, since 94, I've been kind of working on studying the craft of writing novels. And I published, I think the first time was 2001. And I just kept, I'm just keeping, keep it on, trying to learn about it all the time.
Now, when you tell that story, one thing that springs to my mind is wondering how your family reacted to, you know, first they had a seminarian on their hands, and then they had a political protester. Was that a difficult transition for your family to make?
Yeah, they were kind of overjoyed to have the seminarian. You know, that was a great thing, I guess, to have to think of a son going into the priesthood. But then I left the seminary, and then I went. I was breaking the law, and there was federal marshals delivering summonses to the house, and you know, that was just total torture for me and for them, and for, you know, it was in the news, and I'd write letters to the editor, and sometimes I would walk from Norfolk. This is when I was living in Norfolk, Nebraska. I remember a couple times during Holy Week, I walked from Norfolk to Omaha, and then I would end up at my destination as Offutt Air Force Base, and then cross the line. And that, you know, that was it. Was the purpose was it was to get as much publicity as I could and to talk about it. And so it's, you know, Norfolk's about 20,000, and it's where I went to high school, and you know everybody and all that. And yeah, it's just tough stuff. Sometimes I would have, when you go to the Air Force Base and you, with the, your crime is trespassing, you step over a line, and you get something called a ban and bar, and you can, those are things you can take home with you. So sometimes I would put them up on, or a couple times put them up on the bulletin board at going into the church. You know, I just tried to speak out as much as I could with in the church and in the community. Yeah, it was very, very hard.
I bet. Now, you're with your novels, with your writing, you're still speaking out, and I would expect still creating some controversy.
Not as much as I'd like. I think because, I don't know, I just, nobody really, I just keep saying this, I guess, because I think that's what a lot of people will read a letter to the editor in the newspaper. If you write that, you'll get some comments. But if you write a novel, almost no matter what it says, it's hard to get those novels into anybody's hands or to read them. So that's really the hard thing is, you want to say what you have to say, but then also to get that disseminated and distributed is kind of a tough deal. So I don't know. There really hasn't been as much flack as you know.
Not as much as you expected, huh?
Well, that sounds kind of weird, but you want to at least be having people hear it and having some traction and at least making a difference, because that's why you write it. Maybe that's coming down the line. I don't know. But I think we talked about this last time. To me, it's a tough time, or maybe there's never been an easy time to write novels or social protest or social justice books and have as many people read it as you want to. It seems to me that books like, we talked about Grapes of Wrath last time, it seems to me that those were perhaps read more I just can't think of any social justice novels who are kind of household names or on the tip of our tongues these days, and it's just kind of a weird time. I don't know if you feel the same or not.
Well, we talked about, John Steinbeck and The Grapes of Wrath and some of his other novels were very much social commentaries. And Caroline, as the former English teacher, do you know if they were popular at the time they were published?
No, I don't know. But, you know, the time, everything has changed so much. People read more then. Now it's television. And, you know, it's a whole different, culturally, it's a whole different thing.
That's true. They didn't have Jon Stewart back then.
No.
They did. Yeah.
Yeah, they had John Steinbeck. And when did you read those? I'm imagining that type of book was an influence on you.
Well, Well, it was, but it wasn't until like 94. You know, I wasn't a star student or anything like that. At Norfolk High, I think I was like 280, in the 280s out of 289 graduating class. I mean, I barely graduated, and I didn't read that much, I guess. And I just, when I, and in 94, I started to read, because I thought I better have read a few novels before I start to try to write them. And I just, that's when I brought Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer to In Cold Blood, and I went to the Rochester. We were living in Minnesota at the time. We ran a small newspaper in southeast Minnesota about Byron, Minnesota, is about 7 miles east of Rochester. So I would go to the Rochester Public Library, and I would haul home arms full of how to write books and grammar books and dictionaries. I'd read the dictionary and all these novels, and I would just think, wow, you know, and Moby Dick, and I'm 52 now. I guess, you know, I was in my late 30s or early 40s before I really started to get into this.
And are you still, do you feel like you know how to write a novel now, or you feel like you're still learning?
God. I don't know. I guess you're always still learning, but
yeah.
I'm excited about it. I mean, I've got one coming out in August, and I've got two more that I can't wait to put out next spring, and I've got three more that I want to write. So I'm excited about it, and it's just a lot of fun. To the writing part, the creative, just sitting down and actually being able to just write is the fun part. I think it, the other part of having enough money to print and to find a way to distribute and to find readers, and you send out all these emails and you get back people saying, you know, remove, you know, don't send me these anymore. That's the salesman part is the tough part. But I don't know if I know how to write, though. It's real enjoyable. I guess I could say that.
Well, we've talked to, you know, there's very famous stories about writers who faced a lot of rejection before they became eventually very successful, and we had some of the Chicken Soup for the Soul writers on our show. And do you remember how the original Chicken Soup for the Soul book, how many publishers they went to before they were accepted?
300.
it's incredible.
They finally found a small publishing company in Florida that said, yeah, we'll take a chance on you. And look what happened. Well, the first, everybody else said, oh, it's a stupid title. Nobody will buy it, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So never know.
And even some of the, like, I know there's a story about John Grisham, who of course has written so many best-selling novels, couldn't sell his first one until he was able to sell a second one, and then they published the first one.
Ah.
But he wasn't able to sell his first one to begin with. And who was some of the other?
So sometimes you just have to persevere, don't you?
Yeah.
It's like a lot of things. You just have to keep trying.
So in your route to publishing, Mike, what are some of, you know, how have you published? Have they all been self-published, or have you used small presses? What are some of the ways that you've published your work?
Well, the first one, KGB, and we talked about that before, that was Publish America, and then I found Badger Books in Madison, Wisconsin, and Howling Dog Press is in Denver, New Hampshire Writers Collective, or Publishers Collective, that was for The Truth. I just found all these on the internet. I just, you know, searched. I did that. I have done the send out to major publishers, and I tried the agent route, and I sent money to people who said, it just needs a little bit of polishing, and with 700, one person with only $1,500, but we'll give you a deal for $750. We just need to polish it up, and we can, and you'll be able to send it out. And, you know, things like, and just, you know, and a writer, especially when they're starting and they haven't heard any of this stuff, obviously I did. I paid money to hear these, somebody say, I am a writer, and to hear that positive voice. Yeah, I went through all that, and I tried to, I find, found agents, or I don't know if they were even real agents, that said they were marketing it. I've never really found a real agent. You know, every couple of years I'll go on the list of agents in New York, and I'll send out blurbs to a larger publisher and send out things. But it never really works for me. But I found these small publishers who I had to pay money to them, though. You know, it was like they call it collective, or cooperative publishing.
Right.
So at least there were books out there. And with this last one, I just decided that I would try to do it myself.
Now, are you using print on demand?
Yeah, I guess that's what it is. I don't have the software myself to do it, so someone who published one of my books, Teresa Basile in Chicago published, she has New Leaf Books. She published my book, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and she knows how to do all that, so I pay her to do the layout, and then I also send her the money for the printing, and she finds a printer in the Chicago area, and we print like with Iowa Terror, we printed, I think it was 400 copies, and I guess it's print on demand. If I need more, I print them, I guess, if I have the money. I sent out tons of them to reviewers and I had postcards and I took a book tour to the Western United States, and I have a website and all these different ways that you can just find of marketing, and I'm trying Facebook ads and Craigslist and blog ads. I'm trying that, and I'm trying to get up to hype up the book that's going to be coming out in August.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your book tour, because you actually got some publicity from that tour in the Des Moines Register.
Yeah, that was great. Mike Kilen, K-I-L-E-N, he came out to up here to Sheldon, which is a long drive, and he talked to me here, and he wrote something up. I think it was in couple months ago, perhaps.
May 27th, I think, okay. And it's available in the Des Moines Register online. And the title is Protester Takes His Writings on the Road.
Yep.
And it's sort of like, what'd you say, almost a travelogue or a bit of a partial journal of your travels. You want to tell us some of the highlights from that?
Well, to back up a little bit, last year I took a tour to the East. I had to promote my book, The American Dream, so I went to a lot of places, Iowa City, Michigan, New York City, Boston, and this year I decided to go west to promote Iowa Terror, and also another nonfiction book I'm a part of called Cost of Freedom, which is an anthology of peace stories, people and groups around the country who have been fighting the Bush government all these years. So Cost of Freedom is a grouping of those stories, and that's published by Howling Dog Press in Denver. I started, I left here and I went to Tulsa, Texas, Bisbee, Arizona, Tucson, Las Vegas, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Eureka, I spoke at Chico State University, and then up to Oregon. I was at an anarchist bookstore, Laughing Horse Books in Portland, and I was at Revolution Books in Seattle, and then I went over to Idaho Springs. And I met you could call those folks survivalists, or they're not militia, they're just, I don't know, they're just good folks who don't have much trust in the government. And somehow those kind of groups have kind of adopted me. I come from the peace movement side, but the folks who are kind of on the libertarian side, they seem to we can kind of bond together. And then I went down to Salt Lake City and then over to Denver and Fort Collins. That was the end of it. It was about 4 weeks, and I've got an old, Toyota, 91 Toyota with about 196,000 miles on it. And it made it on both trips to the east and to the west. And each trip was about 10,000 miles. And I sold some books and I got some publicity, and it's it's just another way to keep trying to promote it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mike Polachek. Polachek, author of Iowa Terror and a number of other books. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Iowa Terror is about, Mike?
Iowa Terror is, well, I wanted to write this because I just think we're afraid of all they're making us be afraid of all the wrong people. I mean, what did Chertoff say yesterday or in the news? We should be afraid of terrorists coming in with European passports, and maybe tomorrow it'll be with people wearing purple pants. I mean, I just think it's all a ruse. I think it's a big scam. I remember before one election, you know, we saw the FBI director and the director of Homeland Security, the first one, was his name, Tom Ridge, out in front of the, you know, during a press conference saying we had to be afraid of this or that, or the terror alert was on, you know, whatever color it was on. And, you know, they don't have those anymore. And, you know, it's just kind of obvious that it's a big fake, that it's a big scam. I think the terrorists are George Bush and those in his government. And I think they did 9/11. I think they did 9/11 in order to invade Iraq and to make money. And I think it's all going according to plan for them. And but in order to divert attention, they're making us be afraid of Hispanics or you know, Canadians or whoever, Muslims or your people wearing purple pants. And so in Iowa Terror, I try and make fun of that. I try and poke fun at the idea of being afraid of all those people except the ones that we really should be afraid of. And it's about a guy named Jesus Iowa. And he grows up in a small town in Iowa. He's born of immigrant parents, and he learns that he just is a smart guy, and he finds out the truth about 9/11. But then he's branded the terrorist, and he's pursued by all the traditional idiots we find in some small towns. You know, who just do not see.
Now, you live in a small town in Iowa.
Yeah.
And do you ever have, and you're writing books set in small towns in Iowa sometimes, do you ever have a problem with people thinking you're writing about them and making fun of them?
Well, I am making fun of them. I mean, that's not them specifically, but them certainly in a general sense I am. But no, I don't, because I don't have trouble because I don't have enough readers. I mean, that's my problem. But there is no problem as long as nobody reads it, I guess. but I keep trying. I mean, I'm not putting my light under a bushel basket, so to speak. I'm standing on the street corner and saying, you know, this is what I'm saying. But you know, this is my way to fight against people's apathy against the war. And I've told other folks that this is my way to throw bricks through SUV windows or through the church windows when they don't talk about, or my neighbor's windows when he mows his lawn the day we bomb Iraq, and or the ministers that don't talk about Iraq, who put, last Sunday I was in church here, the United Methodist Church, and walking out, and there's a big support our troops poster, and as you come out of church with all the pictures, and to me that's blasphemous. It really is. I don't know where thou shalt not kill would fit in with these people's theology. So yeah, my books are my way of fighting and screaming and throwing bricks without actually throwing bricks.
Let's talk a little bit about the format of Iowa Terror. It's published as almost a graphic novel, not quite. You know, it's not exactly comic book style, but it is. There's lots of illustrations, and you used a number of illustrators in this project, and it's full color.
Yep.
So, talk about why you decided to publish it that way, and how you found these artists, and how you worked with them.
Okay. Well, I have written, my other novels are regular sized novels, and as I repeatedly say, I don't think I have enough, I don't I don't think people, enough people have read them. So I thought I'd try another way, is to write less, to put less of myself, you know, put less words, fewer words in there, and to put pictures in, because I thought I could, maybe that would be a way to get people to read them. And also I just wanted to try it. And I found the people on the internet. I found Russell Bruchet did the cover. He's from Santa Cruz. And I did meet him on the tour. I stayed with him there one time. And I think he did a great job with the cover. I don't know if you have a cover. I think you do have,
yes.
It has the high V and the small town and the Ford plot with the shadow of the terrorist with the gun overhead. And Allison Healy did three pictures, and she's from Boston. Ian Ward is from North Carolina. He did three. And Benjamin Hine is from, where is he from? Belgium. He's from, can't think of the town right now, but he's in Belgium. And they all agreed to do it for, I think I paid them each $400, and that's not enough, but it worked out. I think they were the best part about it, was all these great pictures. And that's the way I'll have the next book will be like this. And, then I'll have two more regular size, and I think I'll go back to this format if I'm still able to publish them.
Now the pictures are, they're very interesting, and the styles of the different artists are quite unique. But you know, the pictures are, there's a lot of commentary within the picture as well. Did you tell these artists what to paint, what to draw for this, or did they just come up with it from reading the text themselves?
I think most of them, it was their themselves. I'm looking through here, and maybe I told Allison about the, I know I didn't tell Russ about cover. I might have told one of the one on the water tower. I think I had an idea about that, and the guy sitting in the coffee shop. But I didn't tell them exactly what to write. They had. That's the way I prefer to do it. Is to, you know, yeah. I think that's the way I would like to work. Is to be trusted enough to, and especially as an artist, is to be. This is what I would like, and just you're free to do it as you want to. Just so it's not so much of a, you know, I don't know. It's not so much of a job. It's more of a project, a creative. We're doing it together as a creative project. And I think they just did awesome work.
Yeah, you probably get the best work from them by allowing them that freedom. I know my niece is a really amazing artist, but she really doesn't like to be told what to draw or paint. But if you let her do thing, she's it's really incredible.
Yeah, who would? Nobody likes to have somebody standing over them and saying, do it this way or do it that way.
Right.
In any job.
Now, do you, as a newspaper reporter in the past, is what you learned in your journalism career, do you bring that into your novel writing, Mike?
Well, I suppose, when you write a feature story, you know, I guess it's the new journalism that they talked about a while back. They, you know, you look for the detail in the, like Jimmy, I always think about, Jimmy Breslin, about his column writing. I thought that was, he had the best job in the world, as I pictured it, was to go out the door in the morning, right around New York City. He's got, you know, he'd probably going to a crime scene and write about what he sees, you know, probably writing about, and he had something to say about the poor, you know, and about how the poor are treated, and to write about, he wrote about the detail, you know, the telling detail of the cigarette ash floating to the floor or something on the walls or something like that. And then he would come back to his office and, you know, and produce literature on a deadline. And I don't, you know, I just, I, you know, the detail, I always liked feature column writing. I never did like, well, who does, like to go cover a city council or a school board meeting, especially on a regular basis. I mean, it's just, that is just the most tedious thing, but it's necessary, I suppose. But
right.
The feature writing is what I enjoyed, sitting down with somebody who I found interesting and asking them questions about their life.
Now, were you actually the editor of these small town papers?
Well, in my first job was after I got out of jail, I went to back to college at Wayne State. That's in Wayne, Nebraska. And then Ruth and Sam and I moved. I got a job in the Sand Hills. That's in Ainsworth, Nebraska. I got a job on the Ainsworth Star Journal as kind of the reporter. There's only one reporter, and you do everything. I quit because I wrote my very first column. I wrote the Gulf War started, and my column was I don't support the troops. So, you know, there was hell to pay about that. The column's canceled. It says we're not going to lose readers, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I just wouldn't do it. I wouldn't tolerate it. So we moved and we found our own paper in southeast Minnesota. And that's where Ruth and I owned our own paper I think it was 3 or 4 years, and so we were the owners there. It was a circulation of about 1,000, and we won the Newspaper of the Year award once. And then we went out of business that same year we won the award. And then we moved to Cherokee, Iowa. I was the editor, and then we moved to Sheldon, where I was a reporter for the Northwest Iowa Review. And that was the end of it. I quit in 97 to start writing these novels.
And you also, I understand, work with disabled adults?
Yeah. Since September of 2001, I work at Hope Haven. Hope Haven is an agency in Rock Valley, Iowa. There's a number of different residences and workshops, and it's a group home of about 12 people.
So that's kind of a long ways away from journalism.
Yeah.
As a career path.
I just have no desire to be back in the newsroom, even though, I think newspaper work, being a reporter, is probably the coolest job you could have. But you aren't able to say, I don't think, what needs to be said, or it isn't said, or somehow it doesn't happen. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just, American journalism today. I don't know. Where do you hear anything about 9/11? You know, about the truth about the Iraq War. It's just always the same old blather, I think. And so I have to say what I have to say in my book. So yeah, even though being a reporter is so cool to be able to, you know, you go places you would never go if you were by yourself. You'd be go talk to these big shots in town. You know, they sit around and they're talking about the new development or something. They're listening to your questions. I mean, sometimes you wake up and you see yourself in those places and you think, why am I here? So it's really cool when you go at sporting events, you get right down in front. But still, there's just not enough being said, I don't think.
Well, there is a lot of criticism of the media today of being, of not really speaking out, being too beholden to corporate interests, too beholden to the money interests. But particularly with the internet, there is an outlet for just about any type of opinion or expression that you want to do, I think.
Yep, that's true. But yeah, it is, and I guess that is true. In some regards, it gets to be kind of an internal discussion or a family. It doesn't.
That's true.
You
end up preaching to the choir.
A lot of it is, but it is something, you know. And I come from the times of Lee Harvey Oswald and all that, and I really, you know, at those days we didn't have the internet, so we believed everything that was in the Norfolk Daily News or that was on WJAG radio. And of course Oswald did it, and of course the discussion is over. But now we're able to talk to each other, and the discussion is not over just because some people say it's over. So that's a very good thing.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline on KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Our guest today is a resident of Northwest Iowa, Mike Polacek, author of Iowa Terror. One thing I thought was interesting was in Iowa Terror, there is a character, a bit part, perhaps, but of a newspaper, of a small-town newspaper editor who gets into some trouble by printing something that other people don't think she should.
Yeah, we don't know if she does get in trouble. Our narrator says that maybe she should be fired for printing this letter to the editor. And I think that's, you know, a lot of, you know, you might get that in a small town, is that this shouldn't be in the paper, so somebody should be in trouble. I think that's kind of common, or at least I ran into that a lot, was that some things shouldn't be in there. You know, you should keep this out of the paper. You know, I found that with city councils, I found it with individuals, that this, some things should not be in there, and that's just not true. It should be an open discussion.
Now, in the last Liberal Outlaw, it sounds like that plot has maybe comes a bit from your experiences in journalism.
Yeah, right. The last Liberal Outlaw is about an editor who gets to this town and they're building a new federal prison, and so he fights the building of it, and he fights the city council who and the Chamber of Commerce and the bank and this or that. And I guess I had Cherokee, Iowa in my mind when I was writing that. I think I just, the different places around town, I don't think you can avoid it. Your mind has to go somewhere. You try not to be too specific, but that's where I think I was writing that. And it was the way I see a newspaper reporter or editor, how he should be, you know, standing in Main Street with his Macintosh in his hand, you know, staring down the bad guys down at the other end of the street and saying that he's not going to move, that he's going to fight. I think that's what, you know, I think that is what journalism is really all about. I think that's when people go into, when young people go into journalism, I think that's what they see is this, I think they go after the crusading, might against right, idealistic idea of journalism. And, you know, for me in Ainsworth, Nebraska, when I had my column shut down just because I was trying to speak what I thought was the truth because it would cost us money, I thought, boom, there goes my bubble. You know, that bubble is just burst. But I wasn't, you know, and I think that example can go way up to, you know, from that small town in the Sandhills can go way up to, like, the boardrooms of CBS or whoever. It's not going to cost us money. You know, we're in this for money, and that's it. One time I was running for Congress, so I was waiting to go to a radio interview somewhere in Northwest Iowa, and I was just browsing around. I saw on the bulletin board, this little thing was printed, this station exists solely to sell the products of the advertisers, and I thought, whoa. You know, but I guess that's the truth, but I just don't see it. Maybe that's how things keep going, but not with me. I just don't understand that.
Well, that's commercial media.
Yeah, I know.
Which
I just
is
don't.
Not what we are.
Right. It was just a shock, I guess, to see that in print. It was just on the bulletin board, so all the employees would make sure they understood
yeah.
the line. And that, yeah. Man.
Well, Mike, why don't you read a selection from one of your novels for our audience?
Okay, I've got Iowa Terror here in front of me, and if I go too long, there are short passages, and I'll just tell me when I should stop.
Okay.
This is chapter one. It's called A Good Democrat, and as I said, I ran for Congress as a Democrat in Northwest Iowa in 2000, and I guess I have my reasons to be critical of the Democratic Party. There's some of these chapters are preceded by a quote by Donald Rumsfeld, and the reason for that is because I think he was trying to do anything but tell us the truth, and they're juxtaposed, if that's the right word, with some quotes from Bill Hicks. And Bill Hicks is a comedian that he's dead now, but he was trying to tell us the truth through his comedy. And this is Donald Rumsfeld. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. Donald Rumsfeld, United States Secretary of Defense, February 12, 2002, Department of Defense news briefing. Someone was killing the Democrats of Orange County, Iowa. I wouldn't have cared, but that I was a Democrat. I did not much care to have my throat slit as I pulled into the garage or have my brakes fail and plow headlong into the concrete culvert out on the bypass around the curb by the new Taco John's and have my head split like a good watermelon, or have a 50-pound sack of sugar fall on my neck from the top shelf as I bent down to try to read the label on the All brand with my trifles. The prime suspect was Jesus Iowa, the terrorist. Jesus lived here in Orange County somewhere, on the back streets or soft dirt roads or in the cornfields. Who knows? Who cares? I might have seen him once in a blur in the very early morning out the front window of my auto parts store. Who cares? Maybe the Democrats. Maybe me. You can buy a list of all the registered Democrats from the Secretary of State in Des Moines. I did that once. I used it to get signatures to get on the ballot. Suppose you could also use it for selling All brand or mass murder. To me, I wouldn't go to the trouble. The Democrats are dying anyway. You don't have to get up even. Just sit on the porch and drink piña chicadas. That's my new invention. And watch them drop. Am I kidding? Ask my wife if I ever kid. Ask my kids if I ever kid. And I'll keep...
Yeah, keep going.
I'll keep going. This one is called Orange Alert. And what happens is that this county used to be called Gay County. And in order to be on the front line against terrorism, the county commissioners wanted to change it to Orange County, and they had everything painted orange. There was the orange water towers, and the teachers had orange dress-up day every Friday, and there was orange buttons, orange everywhere. Well, I guess the orange thing is okay with me. It's going to have to be, right? The same as I don't have much control over the price of gas or what movies they stock at Movie Gallery or how big are the hamburgers they at A&W. Or the war, really, or taxes, or the cost of a speeding fine, or whether the kids start school before or after Labor Day, or whether the commissioners raise taxes to build a new Supermax County jail. The paper says they are talking about having all-year school. I'm sure they won't ask me, and I'm not sure what I would say if they did. We get the paper, mostly to see who died and who got arrested. I tell the wife to check to see if I'm in there yet. If not, I'll have pancakes and coffee. There have been a lot of Democrats dying, though, I'll tell you that. And there aren't that many around here to begin with. Dennis isn't at coffee anymore, or Walter, and the wife says Mary Thomas hasn't been at Ladies Club for 2 months, and that's not like her at all. Yeah, why would there be a terror plot to kill Democrats? I don't know. Mostly terrorists would want to kill Republicans, I would think. That's what the wife said, and I had to agree she sounded about right. Although, you know, the anthrax back then went to Democrats, too, and so the terrorists must have been wanting to send a message to Democrats. Something, definitely something. And people talk, they always talk. Some remember Jesus Iowa and the Hail Mary pass on fourth down that beat Plum Valley in the playoffs. So having him just drop off the edge of the earth like that gives people something to talk about, to do, some energy. They never had a write-up about how he died, so I think he's alive. His folks still have the restaurant. We went there once, gave us both gas. Sure, I tried again, but not the sauce so much. People lock their doors now in the houses, cars, put locks on their lawnmower sheds. You never know. The town has changed. Lots of Mexicans around. Is there a fire or a fight or something worse? It's always, was it Mexicans? And then they give the names Rodriguez or Julio or Pablo, and then nobody listens to the rest. If they kill each other, what's it to us? And so some of the more intellectual coffee clutches at the Hy-Vee Deli or the card players in the back of the barbershop, older guys who aren't there to sell shoes or insurance, who've got more time to really get into a subject, well, they've been wondering about the connection between Jesus Iowa and the Democrats. It kind of grows on you, gives the guy some oomph. You talk about it, and then you want to go home and hash it over with the missus. Maybe you get your neighbor to turn off his mower for a minute so you can come over and bend his ear. And then...
Yeah, keep going. We've got a little more time.
Okay. This one is called Securing the Perimeter. It's the narrator is up on the water tower looking for terrorists. He says, is this heaven? Well, from up here it kind of does maybe seem like that. I'm way up here on the water tower. Not on the water tower, on that walkway that goes around. We've got one of those silver pointed ones, not so big, not like the big round white ones they have in Des Moines and Cedar Falls. Ours depicts at various times the town name, the current graduating class, the current mayor's current girlfriend, and the current state of the local educational system via spelling acumen. Well, I have been stationed here by the local city council to look for terrorists, for Jesus Iowa, maybe his gang. He might have a gang. That's some of the reports we've been getting. I'm scanning the perimeter, looking for the Iowa terrorist, Jesus Iowa, as well as any other terror types. Hey, they gave me this cool pith helmet with netting and a beeper. I get a beeper. I've tried it. It beeps. And I've got this assistant, Jordan. He's going to be in fifth grade in the fall. He sends me up extra water on this pulley system he fixed up. And, well, anyway, maybe I'm facing the wrong way, but what I see is Mrs. Vander Vandreessen pulling into the Hy-Vee lot. She's been pulling in for most of the morning. There's a special on iceberg lettuce. And I see Jared Vanderboom. He's been driving around the cruiser, mostly watching me. There's most of the city council coming out of coffee at family table. They're not really supposed to get together like that. It makes people think they're planning, making decisions outside the meetings. They're pointing up at me. Hey, guys, there's a spire of St. Judy's Catholic Church over in Creameryville on the other side of the corn and soybeans in the river and the dump in the National Guard Armory. There's the lights on the ball field, the construction site for the new middle school next to the high school. The kids arranging the lawn chair sale display in the Pomida parking lot. Some of our teams went to state last year. The one act group got a gold medal in Ames. They always do. It's a tradition. And I can see apple pies cooling and blueberries ripening, and I hear cardinals. The noon whistle of the white picket fence factory is more of a toot. And I can see how Jesus Iowa would want to ruin it all. It's rumored that he hates us for our hand-sized bluegills and the smell of wood smoke and lawn leaves, and he steals leaves. As any good terrorist knows, the way to really stick it to freedom is to demolish icons. Well, I'll keep my eyes peeled. Is this a great country or what? That is the question.
Thank you, Mike. That was Mike Polacek reading from his book, Iowa Terror. Mike, tell us a little bit about the book you've got coming out in August.
It's called Guests of the Nation. The title comes from a Frank O'Connor short story, so I'm borrowing the title for a while. It's based on 9/11. It says that George Bush did 9/11. It's like Iowa Terror in format. It's got color pictures, color illustrations. I've got, let me see. Russell did the front cover again, and there's two other artists who have contributed, and it's almost, excuse me, Allison Healy is just finishing up hers now. And I think we'll have it ready by August and find some way to promote it.
And then what else do you have in the works?
Oh, I've got two more that are done, but I wanted to put them out before Christmas, but Ruth told me that Emily needs her wisdom teeth out, and we had to get another car and stuff like that, so I had to put it off till spring. So I've got two more written. One is called Speak English, and one is called The Progressive Avenger. But those are having covers done too, and I'll put them out in the spring, I hope.
What is the Speak English one about?
Speak English is another one about immigration, and it's also I think the cover will be. I started out writing about my hometown in Norfolk, Nebraska, and how we used to go road hunting on the country road, and one time I went back to Norfolk, and I just went there for the purpose of taking notes for a new book, and the notes part just came so fast, and every little place I went to, there was a memory, every street I go on, something I want to include. But anyway, it's about, I think the cover, to give you an idea, might have these guys pointing a shotgun at a group of Hispanics trying to get into the country. And it's about immigration, it's about bigotry, and I guess I'm just not over that yet. Even with writing about Iowa Terror, I'm not over, and I don't want to get over it. The whole Hispanic immigration thing, I think we're treating Hispanics the wrong way. We should, to me, they're poor people who are just trying to make a better life to get their kids on a bus route, and we're trying to, and we want to protect the border, the homeland security. That's another example. Protect us against poor Mexicans, but let George Bush drive around the country unabated, and that really burns me. So I just,
you know, I have read stories about where, like, the INS has done raids, and there was a small town in Iowa where the townspeople are actually standing up for the immigrants.
And, that's great.
Yeah, and saying they are part of our community, and we do want them here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might not be everywhere, but I know that there are some places.
There were a lot of abuses in the plant as well. Mm. Against the workers, and those are coming to light. But it you know, upset the whole equilibrium of the town, because now teachers have to be fired because, you know, it upset about 1,000 families, and so, you know, it was quite something. Actually, the Catholic Church is leading the charge for the immigrants.
Really?
Which makes me very proud. Yes.
Yeah, the last time I was in San Antonio, Texas, and went to the Alamo. I was looking at reading the history of the Alamo, and what people don't realize is that the whole Alamo situation occurred because of illegal immigration the other way. The, you know, Texas, as we know, was part of Mexico, and they wanted more settlers, and they invited people from the United States to come down and settle in Texas. And then there got to be too many of them coming, and so they put a stop to it. And they said they couldn't come anymore. And then the ones who had who were there rebelled and said they wanted to become part of the United States instead of being part of Mexico. And so it's like, well, that all belonged to the Hispanics. And also, if you read the list of the soldiers who fought on the side of Texas at the Alamo, many of them were Hispanic.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Many of them were Hispanic. And there are Hispanic families in our Southwest who have been there for longer than any of us have been here. You know,
yeah.
And so to act like they don't have a right to be there is bizarre. It really is.
It all matters who has the money to print the history books, doesn't it?
Well, probably, yeah. Probably so. So do you have a special routine for writing, or does it you just write when the spirit hits you, or how do you do that?
I've tried to do it the right way. You know, we get up early in the morning and write for. I think I did that for some books, but I don't know. I write longhand now. And I a lot of times when I'm driving, I'll get a note that I want to include. So I'll just kind of reach all over the car while I was going and try and find some paper and pen and write. And I'll come up and I'll have a collection of notes, and then I write the notes down, and somehow I try and piece the notes together, and then I've written it. I write at work, and then I put it together on the computer. I don't know. I don't really have a routine, but somehow it gets done. I think it takes maybe 6 months for a book or more. Maybe.
So you have it. You have a day job. You have a job.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Pays
I
the
work,
bills.
I work at a group home.
Well, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, we have Hope Haven in Burlington, and a satellite in Mount Pleasant where I live. And
really?
Yeah, Hope Haven has been there quite a while, and it's quite successful. It has a thrift store now that people like to go to, and it does a lot of good. I have a couple friends who are clients of Flex. They call it Flex Services in Mount Pleasant, and a couple young women, and they enjoy that. It's really good for them.
Yeah, it's good to be around those folks. It really feels good to be around them.
Well, Mike, thank you for joining us today on Writer's Voices. We've been speaking with Mike Polacek from Northwest Iowa. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about your books?
There's a website. It's www.mikepolacek.com, and the last name is Palecek. And thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And are they also available on Amazon and from, like, could a bookstore order a book?
Yep, you could. You could go to Amazon, or you can order a book. I don't know if a bookstore, you might have to have the ISBN number, but I'm not sure how that works.
Which
they're out there somewhere.
And the ISBN number is available on the website, so you can could look there if somebody wanted to order the book locally.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad we got through okay.
Yeah, we made it through. And good luck with your writing.
Thank you very much. See you guys.
Goodbye. Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're about done for the day. That was Mike Polacek from Northwest Iowa. Interesting guy, history.
Yeah.
And a prolific writer.
I'll say. What, 10 books?
10 books. This book that we were talking about, Iowa Terror, is pretty short. It's only like 60 pages, but I was looking, some of his others are like 496 pages, 332 pages. And he keeps writing, keeps putting them out there. He's very dedicated.
I'll say.
What he's doing.
Yeah. Well, someday somebody will pick him up, and somebody that has some clout in the literary world, and will write a review, and then he's off to the races.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes, isn't it?
Well, I'm going to be doing a little bit of writing this weekend. I'm at the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival.
All right.
Taking a course, a weekend course from Cecile Gauding on, it's called The Heart of the Personal Essay. So personal essays are not something I've done a lot with in the past, so it'll be good to... To delve into that a bit.
I guess I'll have to interview you sometime, Monica.
Oh, that would be fun. Yeah, we should definitely do that. But if you're staying in town this weekend, I say go to the Sondheim Center. See Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And there's all kinds of other delightful things going on.
Their productions are amazing. And there's not a bad seat in the house.
That's true.
So wherever you choose to sit, you will have perfect view, perfect audio. It's just really great.
And, of course, tonight on the square, let's hope that the weather holds. We've got Bamboo playing on the square, and that is one of my all-time favorite local bands.
Mm-hmm.
So I plan to do a little kicking up my heels before I head off for the cerebral environment of the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival.
And I'll be talking
to
Barbara in
2 minutes. Oh, and you'll be talking to...
Barbara.
Oh, James is going to have Barbara from Bamboo on in a few minutes.
Wow. All right. Well, that worked out well, didn't
it? Fantastic.
Indeed.
So we will close today, as always, with a quote from Mom.
Okay, I don't know who said this, but it's good to remember that a dead end is just a good place to turn around.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.